Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
Trip to YouTube offers a nearly unlimited selection of the stunning abilities of octopuses. They can change color to camouflage themselves, unscrew jar lids to escape tight quarters in captivity. They can shoot jets of water at a light switch across a room to turn off an annoying glare. But what does it feel like to be an octopus? What do they actually think? And what might an understanding of their view of themselves, such as it is, tell us about our perceptions of being alive in the world? From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Some 600 million years have passed since the existence of the last common ancestor we shared with cephalopods, a little worm-like being without much of a nervous system. For all the time since, we've been evolving in different directions. But even with so little shared history, we coexist today and can see and respond to one another with very different equipment for sensory processing, movement, and thought. Peter Godfrey Smith has spent a lot of time considering what those differences might tell us. He is Distinguished Professor of Philosophy at the Graduate Center, City University of New York, and Professor of the History and Philosophy of Science at the University of Sydney. His new book is called Other Minds: The Octopus, the Sea, and the Deep Origins of Consciousness. Peter, welcome to Think.
It's a pleasure to be here.
You've had some extraordinary experiences with octopuses and other cephalopods, not least of which are these encounters that you define as mutual engagement, this idea that they are as interested in you as you are in them. Why is that so striking?
It's striking because they're such different animals. I mean, as you were saying in your introduction, we're talking about animals that diverged from our path in evolutionary terms such a long time ago, really at close to the dawn of animal life, certainly the dawn of complex animal life. And they've wound up with similar senses in some ways. I mean, they're very visual animals, cephalopods, just as we are, but profound differences in other ways. So when you find an animal that's that different and is also interested in, you know, in some sense of interested in you, it's a very striking experience.
And that long split in time makes the differences in our intelligence and even in our consciousness interesting, because it didn't evolve sort of for the same reasons along the same lines that our own has. Is that right?
Right. It's unclear. I mean, lots is unknown in all these areas. It's unclear both how smart they are and why they got so smart. People have thought often that when you look at the size of a nervous system in an octopus, there's a kind of excess there. It seems too big a nervous system given the life of the animal. People have occasionally wondered whether it was a sort of an accident, a kind of fluke in some sense, that they wound up like this. I suspect it's not. I think they're so engaged with the world. They have such a strong exploratory tendency that, you know, all that brain power is doing stuff for them. Why exactly on this one particular path in evolutionary terms we got this striking outcome, that's still in many ways quite puzzling.
So octopuses are well known for touching and inspecting objects that they don't have any business with, right? Like, they're not going to eat things, but they'll still pick them up and feel them.
Right. I think for me, this is one of the most striking things about them. Their intense curiosity about all sorts of novel objects. I should say at the outset here that, you know, we're going to be generalizing about octopuses. There's about 300 species, and they differ very much one from another. Some particular species, including the ones I hang out with in Australia, have this strongly exploratory tendency. Not all of them do. So this is a quirk of some and not all. But within those ones, then, as you say, it's common for octopuses, and I think fairly rare for many other animals, to take a strong interest in objects that I think, in this case, they can pretty quickly work out to not have much of a utilitarian role. You can't eat them. You can't do much with them. An example would be tape measures. When I dive with these animals and bring down, as I quite often do, a sort of brightly colored, like a builder's tape measure with a tape on a spring, those are extremely interesting to octopuses. It can be quite hard to get them back. there have been cases where I'm trying to measure something and the octopus will hold quite determinedly one end of the tape so I can then stretch out the rest of the tape. It's quite helpful.
You, Peter, are a philosopher, so I'm curious about how your approach to this discipline that is really all about the mind and about ideas changes when you're considering how a creature's existence might be shaped by the form of its body and the physical environment in which it lives.
Yes. The idea that the form of the body of an animal has really profound and large-scale effects on the kind of consciousness it has or the kind of mind it has was a very neglected idea for a long time in philosophy. I mean, perhaps this is not surprising, but in philosophy, people have tended to have often a very intellectualized view of what the mind is. I mean, that sounds like an obvious thing to have, but the idea that there's a tight connection between the kind of body you have, the kind of actions and motions you can engage in, and the kind of mind you have, it was for a long time something of a fringe idea. It's now become a lot more prominent. And that's one of many ways in which the octopus is a kind of an ideal animal to think about, because their bodies are about as different from ours as a body could reasonably be. And then to think about what that does to the experience of the animal and the way it encounters the world is especially interesting.
So one major difference is that although octopuses have brains, they have lots of neurons in other parts of their bodies, specifically their arms, and they have this sort of, is it cognition within the individual arms?
They have, right, as you say, so most of the neurons in an octopus are outside of the sort of head area, and in particular in the arms, especially the sort of upper part of the arms. So roughly two-thirds is that's the standard figure that people give. It's unclear still how much autonomy the arms have and to what extent those peripheral nervous systems within each arm give the arm a kind of, you know, what you might think of as a sort of a very minimal intelligence, something like that. It's unclear, as I say. For a while, you know, if you go back some decades, when people began to explore the anatomy and the nervous systems of octopuses, they were surprised at first, not just by all those neurons outside the head, but about the slim nature of the connections between the nervous system in the arms and the central nervous system. So in a famous book from some years ago by Roger Hanlon and John Messenger, a big survey of cephalopod behavior, they said it seems that the arms are curiously divorced from the brain, which is a very nice phrase. And that suggests a kind of autonomy. It's hard to work out how much autonomy. The best experiments I know that bear directly on this come out of a lab in Jerusalem, Israel. Benny Hochner is a scientist whose lab does a lot of work on this topic. And the tendency of those results, I mean, there's just a few things, it's still hard to say, but the tendency of those results has been to suggest that when an octopus wants to exert top-down control and just tell an arm to do something, it can. They've had some nice results where an octopus had to send an arm down a very definite path guided just by vision, so the arm couldn't sort of explore with tactile and chemical sensing its own way. They've got results where the octopuses could learn to sort of direct an arm. Now, that doesn't tell us what the arm is up to when it's not being told what to do by the brain. And my own impression is that there's a kind of exploratory behavior that arms often tend to engage in that looks at least as if it's somewhat autonomously controlled, rather than being something the arm's being told to do by the brain. So you can think of a kind of a sort of idle exploration as something that the arms can probably do by themselves. And the arms have a tremendous array of sensory capacities. They can touch things, of course, but everything they touch, they also taste. They are, you know, remarkably sensitive, you know, organs, really.
You have a wonderful metaphor in the book about the brain of an octopus being maybe like a jazz conductor, and the individual arms are like players, and they can get some suggestions from the conductor, but they're going to improvise.
Right. They might go their own way. Yeah.
Why would octopuses have so many neurons if they are, as we know from looking at human evolution very closely, evolutionarily expensive to maintain?
It's not clear why. I mean, I think I'd be too confident if I said anything very definite about this. One idea that I explore a bit in the book has to do with just the difficulties of controlling a body that is a soft body, a body that doesn't have bones to guide motions. When you think about the human behavior of walking, for example, our bodies do a lot of the walking for us. The way our joints are, the way the bones are, the way the sort of weighting is of parts of the body means that walking is a sort of natural behavior that doesn't require too much fine-grained control from the brain. There's a phrase that was once used, quite a nice phrase. Someone once said that walking really, when you look at it mechanically, it's a kind of controlled falling almost. It's that natural. Now, that feature of many of our behaviors relies on the presence of bones and joints and which guide the motions of the body. In the case of octopuses, if they want a joint, they have to make one. They have to tell the arm to form a kind of elbow. Which does happen. There are behaviors in which a sort of elbow-like joint is formed in an octopus arm. But, of course, because it has to be made, there has to be control, perhaps a mixture of local control within the arm and something that's top-down that determines that the arm will have that shape for a particular time, and then it can, you know, it can do some task. So I think part of the secret of why octopuses have these extraordinary nervous systems might come from the demands of controlling a body like that. Now, I'm not the first person to offer that hypothesis. A number of people have. It's, for example, in that book I mentioned earlier by Hanlon and Messenger, and the idea that the difficulty of control of a body like that requires a very large and necessarily expensive nervous system. I think that's one important idea. So I'd offer that as a first thought. But then beyond that, I think there's that exploratory, that curiosity-driven nature that they have. So octopuses, they're predators. They have to hunt. They have to go and find food. And the way they hunt involves a lot of exploration, a lot of feeling around. They'll try out novel things, work out if they can eat them. So that's a sort of reasonable sort of function for a large nervous system as well.
My guest is Peter Godfrey Smith, distinguished professor of philosophy at the Graduate Center, City University of New York, and professor of the history and philosophy of science at the University of Sydney. We're talking about his new book. It's called Other Minds, The Octopus, the Sea, and the Deep Origins of Consciousness. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or find us on Twitter at @KERAThink.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Fall registration is now open with courses in art, architecture, history, and languages, as well as professional certificates and test preparation. Registration at smu.edu/CAPE.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour to philosopher Peter Godfrey Smith about his new book, Other Minds, The Octopus, the Sea, and the Deep Origins of Consciousness. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or find us on Twitter at KERA Think. Peter, when did the ancestors of modern-day cephalopods lose their shells? And what was the result of that in terms of how they had to develop in order to survive?
I don't know exactly when. Well, it's not known exactly when they did. It's been a while. Yeah, we're talking hundreds of millions of years. Well before the divergence into the sort of present day familiar forms, but also sometime after that branching point that we talked about a little earlier. I think that whenever it happened, though, the loss of the shells. I think of this as a profound event. Different cephalopods did this in different ways. So, in a cuttlefish, there's still a hard internal part, the kind of surfboard-like object in the back, and squid have a hard part also. It's just octopuses who've abandoned almost every hard part, have turned their body into a purely plastic, a purely flexible object, and biologists think, and I think, that this had profound consequences. You can think of it as a pair of consequences. Firstly, it unlocked these extraordinary possibilities for behavior. I mean, just the things you can do if you have a body that can take on pretty much any shape at all, the things you can do are extraordinary. So there's the range of behaviors enabled, but there's also the loss of protection. If you're a mollusk, as these animals are, then a shell is normally a very good thing to have, given the fish around you and their appetites. So to give up an external shell and give up the protection places you in danger in very obvious ways. And octopuses in particular came to live a life mostly on shallow reefs, fairly shallow water in many cases, which are teeming with fish, many of whom would like to make a meal of the octopuses. So the combination of the possibilities of the body and the dangers inherent in the body, I think, was important in setting them down their unusual path.
There is evidence, you have seen this, as have other observers and scholars, there's evidence that octopuses can recognize particular humans. This kind of ability would make sense if, say, they were super social with one another, they mated for life and had to find that person, that octopus who's their person, if they did a lot of caretaking of their young. But none of those things are true. So why might an octopus be able to recognize individuals?
It's a good question. It's a surprising fact. As you say, it's now been shown experimentally, I think with a fair bit of reliability. For years, it was just an anecdotal thing. People in laboratories thought that this octopus had a dislike for this human being and a liking for this other human being. And that's what prompted people to do some experiments on this, where they tried to work out whether octopuses could, in fact, reliably discriminate and behave differently towards people, even wearing the same clothes, was the way the experiment was done. This was done by Jennifer Mather's group. And it was a surprising finding, because, as you say, they don't have any obvious use for a capacity of that kind. And that's one of the things that I tend to think of as pretty much a byproduct. Evolution has built them a big brain, a complex nervous system, and much of what it does is there for some evolved function. It's doing some good for the animal in a way that has a role in the evolutionary history. But I think when you build a brain that big, you get certain things for free. You get some byproducts. And the capacity to recognize individual humans is, I think, pretty clearly, it's got to be a byproduct. It's very hard to think of a plausible function this would have had in the evolutionary history of the animals, not just with respect to recognizing individuals of another species, but even recognizing individuals of the same species. Because, as you say, there's the reproductive habits of the octopus don't involve a great deal of pair bonding and long-term associations or other kinds of social activity.
But that recognition does give us some clues about their access to long-term memory as opposed to just short-term memory. Mm-hmm. How important are those different kinds of memory in just even tackling the question of whether any kind of creature has a sort of consciousness?
Right. Memory of some sort is pretty much ubiquitous in living things. Maybe not strictly speaking ubiquitous, but if you're looking for glimmers of memory, you know, just the most minimal forms, then even bacteria have shown a kind of minimal form of short-term memory. The way that bacteria, at least some bacteria, navigate is by working out whether the chemicals they sensed at the present time are better or worse than the chemicals they sensed a few seconds ago. Mm. So they make a comparison across time. So the idea of using time as a guide to how to behave and tracking the differences between present and past, that's not a peculiarity of complex animals or even a peculiarity of animals at all. Living things that aren't animals can do a good deal of this. So that's, you know, I think that's part of the story, but some kinds of memory have been thought to have some specific connections to consciousness or subjective experience in a broad sense. So in the case of humans, something that people have looked at closely is working memory, which is the kind of memory that is very short-term, very restricted in its capacity, but it's the sort of memory that you carry around, with which you carry around ideas for immediate consulting or use or manipulation. So if you're walking around and someone tells you a phone number and you sort of play that in your head, the digits, that's working memory. Or if someone asks you to sort of visualize a shape and you conjure up a mental image, then they ask you to sort of, you know, they might say, okay, visualize a triangle. Now put a square around the triangle. You put the triangle in working memory and then manipulate it by adding the imagined square around it. That kind of memory, which is low capacity, you know, it can't hold very much, but what it holds can be used in these sophisticated ways. Some people have thought that that's got an essential link to consciousness. My colleague at the City University of New York, Jesse Prince, has written a book in which he argues that that's really part of the key to understanding consciousness in humans and other animals. So then you'd be looking in other animals for that particular kind of memory and asking whether it was present or absent.
Hmm. Is there any way to test whether an animal that is, you know, that can't communicate with us in the standard ways is aware of itself as being separate from its environment, other than, you know, it's not just a collection of sensory experiences?
Awareness of self, I think of as probably a sophisticated kind, or not too sophisticated, but relatively sophisticated kind of subjective experience. So suppose we use the phrase subjective experience to refer very broadly to the phenomenon that involves the presence of feelings, you know, encountering the world in a way that feels like something for the animal itself, and so on. I think that simple kinds of subjective experience of the sort that we might see in animals, you know, like an octopus, probably involve awareness of the world, but not awareness of the self, qua self, or, you know, the self as a distinct component of the world. When you get to animals that have even larger nervous systems, the mirror test, I think, is an interesting way of looking for something like awareness of self, you know, the animal being able to determine that it is part of the world and that I am this animal. So the mirror tests involve placing a little bit of paint or something on the forehead of an animal and then putting a mirror in front of it and seeing if the animal can in some sense register that, oh, that bit of paint is on my forehead, whether they'll sort of use the mirror to inspect it or sort of interact with the mark that's been made on them. And that's a rare capacity. Not very many animals pass a mirror test. To my knowledge, octopuses certainly have not. It's very hard to do things like this with octopuses. I once took down a mirror when I was diving and thought, why don't I just sort of see how they react to a mirror? And the results were so chaotic and complicated that I could not draw any conclusions at all from them.
What happened?
Well, I had a hard time, I think, trying to get the octopus to focus on the mirror rather than me. So I put the mirror there, then went away. Pretty quickly, the octopus worked out that the mirror was an object of interest, you know, like those tape measures I mentioned earlier. It did seem, however, to be somewhat reactive to the image in the mirror. So it wasn't just an ordinary object. It was peering at it in a way that suggested that the image was of some particular interest, but not in a way that I could interpret at all.
How much can any creature do with sentience but not consciousness? How much could we do? How would we be different if we had sentience but not consciousness?
When you ask that, it's a question that's sort of right at the cutting edge, I think. It's hard to work out even how to set up the categories. You know, which are the forms of experience that count as sentience without consciousness? Which are the forms that count as consciousness? Many people who write about this area now use the word consciousness very broadly. That's become habitual in some parts of philosophy and in science. And one thing I wanted to do in the book was to restore a distinction there. And I think that pain is a good example of something that can be used to mark for distinction. So I wonder whether various animals feel pain. I think octopuses probably do. A lot of insects, I think, probably don't. And to ask that question, I don't think is the same as asking whether the animal is conscious. I think pain feels like something. It feels like something to be in pain. It's a form of experience. But it's, I think, a good example of a form of experience which is probably simple in some ways, evolutionarily old, something which has an obvious utility to animals and probably can exist without there being the kind of sophistication that we would normally associate with conscious thought. So things like pain, that's the kind of thing that I think of as my way in thinking about these things.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. Sam in Fort Worth asks a question that you address in the book, which is, why do octopuses have such short lives?
It's such a surprising fact and a rather poignant one that they do have, in nearly every known case, such short lives. 1 to 2 years is a common lifespan for an octopus. I tried to address this in the book by applying some ideas from the general biological understanding of what determines lifespan in different kinds of animals. And the view I offer, and this is, you know, conjectural in many ways, is that they've had their lifespan set biologically by the particular kind of lives they live and by the dangers that they confront. So if you think about, I mean, one way to think about this, I think, in an informal but useful way, is to ask about, you know, saving for retirement. How much money should you save for retirement? You might think to yourself, well, and you can imagine doing this in a situation where if you never get hit by a bus, if there's no external accidents, you would go on living indefinitely. Now, even if you thought you could go on living indefinitely in principle, there's some number of years after which you can assume that some accident will have gotten hold of you. And so there's some amount of money that's too much to save for retirement because it'll be wasted given that you won't make it to that point. And you can think of animals as investing in their natural longevity in a way that's conditioned by the presence of external threats. If your life is so dangerous that something will probably eat you before you're much older than two anyway, then having a body that will not have the durability to get past 2 years or so doesn't really matter because you won't be sort of normally testing the limits of that lifespan. So I think reasoning like this gives us a bit of a sense of how the short lives of octopuses might have been set by their by their particular lifestyle. While we're talking this, I'll just mention one other connection. Whenever I think about octopus lifespan, the combination of the short life and the complexity of their experience, I'm always reminded of the movie Blade Runner with the replicants who are doomed to die after 4 years, but who pack a lot of stuff, a lot of life into those 4 years.
If you set up a lab and were able to put generation after generation of octopus into a really safe environment where nothing would ever get at them, is it possible that they would evolve longer lifespans?
Yeah, roughly speaking, yes. I mean, to do this in a lab is we're talking about numbers of animals and scales that would never be practically feasible. But if we're imagining what it would take in the wild for octopuses to evolve a longer lifespan, then I think imagining circumstances in which they were much safer, in which they didn't have these external threats who made it useless to evolve a more durable body, I think that is the kind of thing we should be thinking about. I think as you relax the external threats that bear on lifespan, you make it more likely that an animal will evolve a longer natural life.
We're speaking this hour with Peter Godfrey-Smith. He's Distinguished Professor of Philosophy at the Graduate Center, City University of New York, and Professor of the History and Philosophy of Science at the University of Sydney. His book is called Other Minds, The Octopus, the Sea, and the Deep Origins of Consciousness. We'll take your calls after the break. The number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also email think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Fall registration is now open with courses in art, architecture, history, and languages, as well as professional certificates and test preparation. Registration at smu.edu/CAPE.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Peter Godfrey-Smith, who's professor of the History and Philosophy of Science at the University of Sydney and author of Other Minds, The Octopus, the Sea, and the Deep Origins of Consciousness. Peter, when you and I think, something like words form in our heads, right? We can maybe feel something or note that it's cold, but in our minds we're thinking something like the words, it's cold. What do we know about what the experience of thought is, such as it exists, for creatures that don't have anything like a verbal language?
Again, you're pressing very hard at the edges of our knowledge. In both philosophy and in psychology, the significance of the stream of inner speech, the kind of monologue that we have, for a long while it was a surprisingly rarely discussed phenomenon. There was a time, people have had very extreme views where they've thought, look, if you haven't got language and if you can't do that stream of speech in your head, then you can't think at all. Some people have thought that. Others have had, in a sense, the opposite view, which is that the business of cognition, the important stuff that our brains do, is not dependent at all on the kind of language that are present in inner speech, and the monologues that occupy our minds are just a kind of froth on the surface. They're not very important. They don't play much of a role. I think there's starting to be recognition of the importance of a middle ground view here, according to which it does make a big difference to the kinds of minds that we have, that we can play in our minds these monologues, that these this stuff is going on. In the book, I have a go at trying to sort of push along this path, and I would like in the future to push further along it. I think it's an important aspect of the unity of human consciousness. I think the sort of the way that we tell a single, serially organized narrative, the way the stream sort of operates, is part of what gives experience its unity. I think it's a sort of powerful way of achieving certain kinds of executive control or self-control, you know, the ability to sort of really exert top-down control over our own behavior. And when we ask, you know, what would it be like to have none of this at all? You know, what kind of experience would there be if there was absolutely none of that? I think it would be a bad mistake to say, well, that there's no experience without it. I think it doesn't make biological sense to think that internalized speech is essential for subjective experience. But because it's so prominent an organizer in humans, it's hard to imagine, I think, what it would be like to go through the day thoroughly without it. There have been a couple of interesting discussions of what you might think of as natural experiments of this kind. There's an oldish book now by a guy called Merlin Donald, a Canadian psychologist, called I think it's called Origins of the Modern Mind or something like that, where he talks about the bits of evidence we have from humans who we have good reason to believe had absolutely no linguistic ability. So, for example, deaf people in pre-literate cultures where there's no sign language, what records do we have of those? There was a guy who was a monk in Canada who, you know, in recent times, this person was written up in papers dating back just decades, who had a kind of aphasia. He would lose suddenly and spectacularly all language abilities, but had to keep functioning, you know, moment to moment. And so he's an interesting sort of natural test of how important it is to our functioning to have a language-based form of thought present. And he was able to do okay. And afterwards, very interestingly, when he'd regained his linguistic abilities, I mean, this was a thing that came and went for him, he was able to say something about what it was like to deal with the world in a way that was, you know, utterly without any linguistic side to it.
It also raises this tantalizing question of when our pre-human ancestors first had something like inner speech or the consciousness that comes with it, the organizing of thoughts that comes with it.
Right, right. And on that question, I'm reluctant to even speculate about dates and the sequence. I think it's a very important question, but not one that I have considered views on.
Fair enough. Let's go back to the phones right now. We have Henry calling from the colony. Hi, Henry.
Hi. Yeah, I just wanted to allude to an earlier discussion where you asked if octopuses could experience pain. And I wanted to know, I've heard of something like called substance P, and that I guess it's supposed to be, you know, what causes pain, I guess, at least in humans, and then if there are pain receptors, and would researchers be able to locate those items and then infer from that yes, that they could actually experience pain as we experience it chemically?
What do we know about that, Peter?
It's a hard problem because there are lots of animals that have some capacity to, you know, detect damage and respond to damage. They have the kind of neurological machinery to do that. But where, for other reasons, we have grounds to doubt that it feels like anything for the animal to be doing those things. So it's very hard to work out, both in the case of ourselves and any other animal, what are the particular kinds of response to bodily damage that indicate that something is being felt and not merely reacted to. Now, with the octopuses, the whole thing is made much more complicated by the fact that, you know, as we talked about much earlier, the evolutionary tree is such that the common ancestor of us is so far back. That animal, 600 or so million years ago, probably could not feel pain. Now, it may well have had a kind of what's referred to as a kind of internal reward system. It may have been able to sort of shape its behavior moment by moment according to whether things are going well or badly. But that's not enough, it's thought, in biology to give rise to feelings of pain or feelings of pleasure. So if we feel pain, and an octopus feels pain, and a bird feels pain, and a crab feels pain — crabs, by the way, are fairly plausible candidates — you may be looking at somewhat different wiring, somewhat different neurological bases for that capacity in each case. And if that's true, then the way to find out whether pain's present in an animal won't be to ask, you know, okay, here's the part of us that does it. Do they have or not have that part? There's been a recent discussion of fish pain in which this particular angle has been debated quite a lot. So there's some behavioral evidence that seems to tell fairly strongly in favor of fish being able to feel pain. Victoria Braithwaite is the scientist who's done a lot of that work. And a couple of critics have said, well, no, I think fish do not feel pain because in us the following structure has to be present for pain to exist, and fish don't have that structure. Now, that's one possible inference, but another possible inference is that the fish have different machinery that is giving rise to the same outcomes, that's doing the same operations. Now, fish and ourselves are not that far apart. Once you get to an octopus, it's even harder, much harder to work out what kind of commonality in the nervous system might be necessary for pain to exist.
There's been this PETA, People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, video circulating objecting to the consumption of live octopus in certain parts of the world. Do you have any opinion on the ethics of whether it's okay, if we don't know for sure, to consume these animals alive?
Let's start with consuming them at all. I mean, the case of eating them alive has a sort of macabre additional side to it, which we could come to in a second. So I don't eat octopuses. I think of that as, to some extent, a sentimental response. So I'm not a vegetarian. I eat various other animals. I think that in this area, the bigger questions have to do with things like factory farming, the sorts of cruel farming practices that are very common in countries like the US. I think that worrying about octopuses but not worrying about pigs would not make a lot of sense. Hmm. I think the evidence that they suffer greatly is much better than the evidence we have that octopuses would suffer from any of these things. Octopuses are, you know, they're not farmed. It would be very hard to farm octopuses. I think someone has tried, but the expression herding cats, I think, is even more apt here. They're not farmed, so that, you know, they're wild animals who have short lives, as we discussed, and as a consequence of that, I think the ethics of eating octopus, the question is not nearly as acute as it is in the case of animals like pigs and battery hens and dairy cows and things like that. Now, if someone has, you know, already eliminated a lot of the clear cases from their diet, and then they wonder about octopuses, then I think it's true that octopuses are, you know, they're smart, sensitive animals, and that's certainly a morally relevant feature of them. I think probably boiling lobsters alive is a much worse practice than anything that tends to be done with octopuses, especially because lobsters have crustaceans of that general kind are good candidates for feeling pain, at least based on various behavioral tests that have been looked at recently. Now, as we get to eating them alive, I'm so far from imagining being able to do that I'm almost at a loss for words.
Fair enough. This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. Let's go back to the phones now. We have Brenda calling from Tyler. Hi, Brenda.
Hi.
Hi, go right ahead.
Okay. I was wondering if octopuses are creative.
Creative. Right. It's hard to say, and it's hard to work out, you know, how best to understand the notion of creativity here. there are certainly things they do that look creative, but whether they're just accidental outcomes of behaviors that have other explanations would be the question. So when octopuses build dens, they often collect all sorts of odd bits and pieces, odd materials, and gather them around the front of their house. They like glass. Bits of glass are very popular with octopuses. Tape measures, I mentioned. I found one octopus who'd found a piece of Venetian blind and was using it as a kind of siding. Another one had a kind of skylight. It had installed a clear piece of perspex above its den, so it could look out through the clear plastic. Now, all of those behaviors are, I mean, from an observer's point of view, they're sort of beautiful and very striking. In at least many cases, I must say, I am curious about the perspex skylight. In many cases, it might just be an accident of, they collect things that are novel and things that might make a useful barrier at the front of their den. And if objects serve that function better than ordinary rocks do, then you'll find those objects gathered. That would be my best candidate for a creative behavior. So we're not talking, we're not talking about a rich kind of creativity, but perhaps we aren't talking about nothing at all either.
You mentioned that you wouldn't eat them for a lot of reasons, not least of which is sentimental, because you do eat some other animals. But do you believe they have individual personalities?
Oh, I think they clearly have individual personalities. I think the notion of personality, it sounds like a very human-specific thing, but in animal behavior research, the idea that individual animals will have distinctive personalities is now a pretty well-studied and well-understood phenomenon. So one dimension that people study when they do personality is the distinction between shy and bold animals, of the same species, same age, same sex. Some individuals will have a shy tendency and some will have a more bold, adventurous tendency. It's hard to tell that kind of personality in octopuses because you have to show it consistently over time. And, any experiment with octopuses that extends over a long period of time is a bit of a hassle. But lots of animals have consistent shy, bold tendencies, and there is some evidence. Jennifer Mather, who I think I mentioned a bit earlier, she's a scientist who's done a lot of work on personality in octopuses, and I think she's pretty confident that they have quite different personalities.
Peter Godfrey-Smith's new book is called Other Minds, The Octopus, the Sea, and the Deep Origins of Consciousness. Peter, it's been a really interesting conversation. Thanks for making time for us.
You're welcome.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Eric Bright. Samantha Guzman is associate producer with help on the phones from Javier Hidabet, and our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. Our Twitter handle is @KERAThink, email address think@KERA.org. I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.